come up with something else to do tonight, and you didn't, and we're grateful for that. I'm going to continue our thoughts in Psalm 22. If you have your outline from this morning, you'll just kind of pick up right where you left off. I have a friend who, in times past, in our relative youth, used to talk about preaching a sermon called Slaughtering Sacred Cows. And the purpose was basically to take a lot of presuppositions and ideas that brethren had that they thought were in the Bible that weren't, or that they, you know, things about the Bible they thought they understand but didn't, and just put three or four of them together into one big outline and just kind of wail away at them, which is something I used to kind of like to do. I don't do a whole lot of that anymore for a variety of reasons, but we are going to take on one topic here this evening that has come up in conversation once or twice before, and every once in a while you hear a conversation about it, and since we were discussing Psalm 22, it comes up. Because Jesus, of course, quotes from Psalm 22, my God, why have you forsaken me? And a great deal of mythology has developed along these lines. It's our tendency as people to fill in blanks. It's what we like to do. The Bible story, of course, is an intriguing story, and certainly the crucifixion is an intriguing story, and very, very few words are used to describe, although the crucifixion is described better than pretty much any other event in Jesus' life, even that, there's innumerable details that are left out. And so we want to make a movie out of it in our head. We want to see exactly how it worked out, and what people's expression was, and why they did it, what their inner motivation was, and things of that nature. And when Jesus says something so intriguing as, my God, why have you forsaken me? We immediately want to dig into that. And the context of Psalm 22, I think, does a lot of good in helping us understand what Jesus was talking about, what he was not talking about, what implications this might have for us. And we're going to talk about that a little bit by way of closing here this evening. But the important thing to understand when looking at this is what we were talking about this morning and the overall thrust of Psalm 22. And that is the notion of the afflicted Christian, the Christian on the verge of despair. What is his status with God? Where does he stand? Where is God in relation to him? And the overall thrust of Psalm 22 just really couldn't be any more clear. And that was the lesson for this morning, if you missed it. God does not forsake his people. And I suggest to you that that's absolutely true. And it's part of a consistent message throughout the text. And the question immediately comes up, of course, if that is true, if God doesn't forsake his people, then why did Jesus say what he said? And doesn't it appear that Jesus himself was forsaken on the cross? And what exactly does that mean? And how might it have happened? And so on and so forth. So we're going to talk about a few things regarding this and helping us to go back to that awful day on the cross and what Jesus was saying and doing and what implications it might have for us. As we discussed earlier, from Psalm 37:24, well, we discussed Psalm 22, but I really like the passage in Psalm 37:25 about the righteous and God's relationship with him. David says, I have been young, and now I'm old, yet have I never seen the righteous forsaken, nor his seed begging bread. And that's a marvelous concept and a beautiful image. I have been young, and now I'm old. I have a lot of experience, says the man of God, and yet I have never seen God abandon his people. Well, there's a reason for that. The reason is God doesn't do that. God doesn't abandon his people. As we mentioned this morning, it may look like he is from time to time. We may feel like he's abandoned us, but in fact he has not done that. If that is the case then, if the righteous are never forsaken, and we're using the word righteous a little bit loosely here, it ought to be emphasized, because none of us is truly righteous, no, not one. All of us have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. And yet, we clearly, as the people of God, are lumped into this notion of being righteous because of God's grace and because of God's patience and forbearance. That being the case, if we, the flawed ones, are not forsaken by God, how could it possibly be that Jesus, who was the only not flawed one, the only one who didn't have sin on his record, how could he be forsaken on the cross? What sense does that possibly make? And I struggle with this. I really do. And we're gonna talk a little bit more about biblical foundation and such as we go along. But the very concept of Jesus being forsaken, ignore for a moment Psalm 22 verse 1 and Jesus' use of it. And think about the concept of Jesus being abandoned on the cross or at any other time as far as that goes. Jesus says in John 10 verse 30, I and my Father are one. And he says similar things throughout, especially the book of John, throughout his ministry, equating his purpose and his Father's purpose, his mission with his Father's mission, his message with the Father's message. They are united in all things. That was seen as extraordinarily presumptuous by the people of Jesus' day. But we see him being the Son of God, that it was not presumptuous, that it was in fact a statement of being, a statement of fact when he said that, I and the Father are one. Which, in the context that we're discussing here this evening, kind of begs the question, how could God abandon himself? How would that work? How would God forsake himself? And why would he do that? And again, as we've mentioned before, the whole point of Psalm 22 is that God does not forsake us. He does not forsake those who are righteous, even when it appears that he has. And certainly, to the average onlooker, perhaps even we, as we look on Jesus at the cross, and certainly the people of that day, Jesus is mocked and ridiculed. The words of Psalm 22 are thrown right back at him. They aren't intending to fulfill prophecy when they do that, I'm sure, but nevertheless they do. If you're really the Son of God, come down from the cross. Yeah, I didn't think so. And so therefore his commitment to the Father's plan winds up being used as an argument against him being the Son of God, in an ironic twist of terminology there. I'm not trying to keep a secret here. I think that we have made a big deal over nothing with regard to this over the years. I think I've heard these statements in times past. I think that not only do we misunderstand scriptures, I think that we decide the scriptures teach something they don't teach when we start putting motives behind God. And Jesus was bearing the sin on the cross, and it was so sinful that God could not bear to look at it, and so therefore he turned away and turned his face on God, on his Son, words to that effect. I'm pretty sure that we've heard that in the Bible somewhere. I'm sure I read that in the Bible somewhere. And I tried to disprove my own point here this week as I was putting this lesson together, the last 2 weeks really. Trying to run as many references as I could, trying to figure out where this idea comes from. And maybe I'm the one that's been wrong all this time. And maybe the people who have the opposite opinion are right. Is there a passage in the Bible that talks about God turning his face against his Son? Is there a passage that talks about him turning away, as it were? And if you have one, by all means, let me know. I suspect there's a lot of people out there saying, well, you know, I'm pretty sure I saw that in the Bible somewhere. I can't put my finger on it exactly. Well, I might suggest you may be thinking of 2 Corinthians, rather, chapter 5 and verse 21. And if you have your New Testaments, turn over there briefly. We may come back to Psalm 22 in a second, but look at the text here and see if this is what we're remembering, because I think this is what I remember. Second Corinthians chapter 5 and verse number 21. He, that is God, made him, that is Christ, he made him who knew no sin to be sin on our behalf, so that we might become the righteousness of God in him. And somebody says, oh, okay, I think that's the one. That's the one there. Jesus became sin. He was sin epitomized, as it were. Somehow, in some horribly twisted irony, the Son of God, the only sinless one, became the embodiment of sin. And there was so much sin on Jesus' back that God could not look upon him. Well, is that really what the Bible says about this subject? Is that really what 2 Corinthians chapter 5 says? I suggest to you that we're looking here at a figure of speech that's really pretty well established in the scriptures, Old Testament and New Testament alike. That when Jesus becomes sin, I want to suggest to you that what that means is that Jesus became an offering for sin. Jesus became what went to the cross, just like the animals in the Old Testament time would have gone to the altar as atonement. Look over in Hebrews chapter 13, and you'll see this same figure being used here, I think. Hebrews 13, and look at verse number 11 and 12. For the bodies of those animals, Old Testament animals, talk about Old Testament sacrifices, For the bodies of those animals whose blood is brought into the holy place by the high priest as an offering for sin are burned outside the camp. Therefore, Jesus also, that he might sanctify the people through his own blood, suffered outside the gate. Now, let me back up to verse number 11. And I'm reading from the New American Standard Bible, as I normally do. And my Bible has the words, as an offering, inserted into the text. Most of the conservative Bible translations are going to supply some kind of key when the words of the text here do not coincide directly with the word in the original manuscripts. And sometimes the words are necessarily implied or whatever, but the implication is so strong that the translators feel like they need to insert words in order to help you understand what's going on. Now, your version may read a little bit differently here, but let's read it without the word, those italicized words. More literally, the text would say this: for the bodies of those animals whose blood is brought into the holy place by the high priest as for sin are burned outside the camp. Well, I think we understand why as an offering was stuck in there, right? They were brought in because of sin. Well, what did this poor animal do? Well, the animal didn't do anything. Animals did animal things. We don't blame the animal for being an animal. The animal was going through all this process because of sin. And that's why it was brought to the priest for the offering, because he was going to be an offering for sin. That was the purpose that it served. And this serves to demonstrate here, I think, that the idea of being, quote-unquote, sin and being an offering for sin is a Hebrew figure of speech. And the one stands for the other, as it were. I'm going to give you a couple of examples of this. In Hosea chapter 4 and verse number 8, there's an interesting passage there. In many of the passages where the Old Testament Hebrews, the Jews, the Israelites, where they're being criticized, oftentimes it's the priests directly who are accused. They're the ones who are supposed to be the representatives for God. They're the ones who are supposed to be bringing the people closer to God. And instead, they are, I don't know if getting rich exactly, but they're benefiting, they're profiting personally from this association, and they really don't have any regard for the people that they're ministering to. Hosea chapter 4, verse 8 talks about these ones feeding on the sin of my people. Now, what exactly does that mean? Does that mean that the more sinful the people get, the better it is for the priests? I can't see how that would work. That doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense. The offering for sin seems to be the point here. Because as you're aware, part of the quote-unquote paycheck, I guess you might say, that the priests would receive for doing their offering, many of these offerings were just burned to a crisp on the altar, but oftentimes they were offered on the altar and we would say cooked or barbecued or whatever. And then the priests would eat that. And so the priests are depicted here as not seeing the people as sinners in need of salvation. They are seeing them as a meal ticket. You know, the more they sin, the more they're going to come and bring us this good prime beef or prime goat or whatever it is, and we're going to offer it up and we're going to eat real good. The more they sin, the better it is for us. Yum, yum, as it were. Well, I would like to think that we would agree that's not the best attitude to take towards sin or towards sinners. They see sin as a beneficial thing. It very well, maybe this is an even deeper figure of speech here, that they are somehow benefiting from the sin of the people in a monetary sense, perhaps. At any rate, we also see this in the New Testament. In Hebrews chapter 9 and verse number 26, and again in verse number 28, you see this coming up. If you are still over in Hebrews, you can flip over a little bit to chapter 9. And verse number 26, the text says, otherwise he would have needed, that is Christ, he would have needed to suffer often since the foundation of the world, that is atoning for sin. But now once, at the consummation of the ages, he has been manifested to put away sin by the sacrifice of himself. Now we'll come back to that phrase in a second. Put away sin. And inasmuch as it is appointed for men to die once, and after this comes judgment, so Christ also, having been offered once to bear the sins of many, will appear a second time for salvation without reference to sin to those who eagerly await him. Now, the phrase comes up twice here. The way the word sin is used in verse 26 and again in verse 28. Look at verse number 26 again. Manifested to put away sin. Jesus is coming here to the earth, his living, his life, dying, his death. This came, he said, to put away sin by the sacrifice of himself. Let me ask you a question. Jesus died 2,000 years ago or so. Has sin been put away? Have we quit sinning? Did we see Jesus on the cross and decide collectively, you know what, we're done with this, no more sin? No, Jesus did not put away sin in that sense. What it means is that he came to put away offerings for sin. And that is the overall context of the latter half of the book of Hebrews here. That Jesus comes to the world as the ultimate atonement for sin. And after him, apart from him, there is no need for any other offering. This theme is developed very intensively, actually, over the next couple of chapters here. That's what he's saying. That because of the sacrifice of Jesus, he puts away offerings for sin. Again, in verse number 28. He will appear a second time for salvation without reference to sin. And again, the New American Standard italicizes here reference to. He's going to come to earth, that is, without sin, is what it literally says. Well, of course he's going to come without sin. He didn't have sin the first time. He's not going to have sin the second time. We understand that. Is that what he's saying here? No, it's not what he's saying here. What it's saying is that he came the first time to atone for people's sins. The second time, he's not coming to atone for people's sins. He's coming to judge people for their sins the second time. And that's what it means here, without reference to sin, or without sin, your version may have here. He's not going to atone for sins a second time. He's already done that. He doesn't need to do it again. And so therefore you see that oftentimes the word sin is used as a figure, as it were, for an offering for sin. There's a very common figure of speech that's used in other contexts also, but that'll do for now. I suggest to you here that Jesus did not end sin. He ended offerings for sin, as we said before. In chapter 10 and verse number 10, he goes on to say, "By this will we have been established through the offering of the body of Jesus Christ once for all." So again, that's the idea, that Jesus came as an offering for sin. And that's an important distinction for us to make. I think sometimes we get caught up in the terminology and don't really appreciate what we're saying here. We might say that, you know, I deserve to go to the cross, But Jesus was punished in my stead. Well, in a sense, we have the Old Testament, New Testament passages that talk about by his stripes we are healed. It's certainly true that Jesus' suffering on the cross atoned for my sins. But understand, Jesus isn't being punished. Jesus is being offered. There's a difference. He is atonement. He's not a punching bag. He is atonement for us. He is, in that sense, our sin. And God is not beating him up because he's carrying sin on his back. God is offering him as a sacrifice to atone for our sin. He is the ultimate and ultimately the only offering for sin. Now that's what I think about that topic. Now, that being said, the obvious question comes up, well, if that's not what Jesus was saying on the cross, if he wasn't saying he was being abandoned by God, well, what was he saying then? Why did he say that? He only said six things on the cross that we have recorded. This one's recorded twice. Surely it must mean something. If it doesn't mean that, then what does it mean? Let me offer you a few things, and then we'll let you have the lesson. Why did Jesus quote Psalm 22 in verse 1? I would suggest in the first place that he wanted to remind his oppressors of the prophecies that they themselves were fulfilling. Jesus is always open to opportunities to bring people to a knowledge of the truth. And that includes people who do not appear very interested in the truth. Now, if these chief priests, and we know that some of the highest ranking officials in the Jewish religion were present for part or all of this episode here at the cross, can we safely assume that they were at least vaguely acquainted with Psalm 22? I would certainly think that they would be. It's their job to be. It's their business to be. Now, we don't have any record here of anybody hearing this verse and saying, hey, he's quoting from that psalm that David wrote. I think it was around the 22nd psalm that he wrote. I don't know if they said that or not. But if they had noticed that translation, that quotation, then surely these men who knew the scriptures backward and forward could have projected forward in their minds and looked at some of these other things that the afflicted one describes. And we touched on this morning. We touched on in the scripture reading earlier. The ones most notably in verse number 8, where the malefactors say, commit yourself to the Lord, let him deliver him, let him rescue him because he delights in him. Surely someone who knew the scriptures and whose mind had already been called to Psalm 22, when they heard somebody else or heard themselves saying the statement, What is that? We're fulfilling prophecy here. This is exactly what David was talking about. David wasn't in the wrong when he was suffering. David was in the right when he was suffering. And now maybe Jesus, when he's suffering, maybe he's not in the wrong either. Maybe he's in the right. That could be at least part of it. And he goes on, of course, talking about dividing his clothing among them, his bones being all out of joint, his tongue cleaving to his jaws, piercing his hands and his feet. Lots of very, very specific terminology here. If someone knew Psalm 22, this should have clued them in that these events that were prophesied about a long time ago, which we may not have understood as being messianic, now perhaps we should understand it that way. And whether they understood it that way or not at the time, we certainly did. Because we can now look back at this fulfilled reality and David's part that he played prophesying about this a long time before and realize that this affliction that Jesus was suffering on the cross was exactly what had always been planned for the Son of God to go through, including the ill treatment and the embarrassment and the ridicule that went along with it, including the specific details about piercing hands and feet and counting all his bones and things like that. I'd like to suggest to you, secondly, that it shows you what his mind was, where his mind was in times of trial. And what a great lesson this is for us. What is your instinct when someone is picking on you, when someone is mistreating you, hurting you, intentionally hurting you, when you're being abused, mistreated, if the world is set against you, you're just under the world's 18-wheeler and just getting run over all the time, what do you think about? Because I'll tell you what Jesus thought about. Jesus thought about Scripture. Jesus thought about God. This is where his mind naturally went in times of hardship, where his mind naturally went in times of difficulty. And the more difficult his circumstances, the more he fled toward God. And as is the case with all sorts of behavior characteristics and habits that Jesus demonstrated in the text, that's a great example for us. If we would be in the habit of reaching out for Scripture, going back over our memory verses in these times, I think we'd be a lot better off. Some people have indexes, I guess you might say, in their Bibles. They have one primary study Bible. They read this all the time. And in the back of their Bible, they will have little subcategories. When you're happy, read these verses. When you're sad, read these verses. When you're joyful, read these verses. When you're afflicted, when you're persecuted, when people take advantage of you, read these verses. When you're angry, read these verses. That's a great thing to do. You can do it without going to all that trouble, but that's a nice shortcut if you're inclined to do that kind of thing. I would certainly encourage you, if you're of a mind, to try something like that. Because the more we can get in the habit of going into the Scriptures to deal with the circumstances, especially the negative circumstances that we run across, I think the better off we're going to be. Passages like Psalm 119, of course, and many, many passages in Psalm 119 come to mind, but I thought of verse number 97, especially in this context. Oh, how I love your law. It is my meditation most of the day. It is my meditation a great deal of the day. It is my meditation when I'm in a good mood. Any day that I happen to be... No, that's not what it says, right? It's my meditation all the day. There is not a circumstance that can come up in our life that cannot be used to turn us toward God. Such was the case with Jesus. Such ought to be the case with us. And I'll give you maybe the most obvious one here. To show his attitude, to show what his attitude was toward affliction. That this ill treatment that he was shown on this day did not deter him. That he saw this as a part of a bigger picture. He saw this ill treatment as part of God's atonement plan. And he was a necessary part, he was an essential part of it, of course. But by participating in this, by being on the cross, by suffering as he did, his attitude toward affliction comes into focus here. None of us is happy to suffer. None of us is joyful, you know, giddy, happy, big smile on our face when we're being led to the firing squad or the rack or the bonfire or whatever it happens to be. And by the way, if you didn't know, when in the first century when they were holding bonfires for Christians, it wasn't a good thing. That's a bad thing. And it really happened. And we have plenty of secular records of people who would go through this and go through it at peace in their hearts, go through it with scripture on their lips, with praise on their lips, because they mimicked the attitude of Jesus Christ. They accepted that such things sometimes were necessary for God's greater plan to be accomplished. I think that in many ways, verse number 28 is the key verse in Psalm 22. For the kingdom is the Lord's, and he rules over the nations. Do we really believe that? Do we really believe that he rules over our lives? We were talking about that this morning. This idea of depression and being beaten down by life. Are we able to turn toward God and say, Lord, I really wouldn't mind it at all if you would change this a little bit. If you could bring me a brighter day, if you could bring me a little sunshine, I would really appreciate that. And I would glorify you if you did. But if you don't, I'm content with that. If you don't, I will still praise you. I will still honor you. Because you're in charge. You are the king of the universe, and you're certainly the king of my life. When we acknowledge God as the ruler over all the nations, what we're saying is that there is nothing that is not under his power. And that should give us tremendous confidence, even in our times of affliction, knowing that it may, again, feel like God has abandoned us, but he has not. And it may be, I don't want to give you too big of a head here, or me, it may be that we're like Jesus in this sense, that what we are going through in the short term and despising in the short term may be accomplishing a reality in our life or in somebody else's life that is far greater than we ever possibly could have imagined, that could not have been done, could not have been accomplished if we had not gone through our version, minimal as it is, of Jesus on the cross. If Jesus can turn toward God in such circumstances, then I suggest to you that we can and we must do so. He does not abandon us. He is with us. And just as Jesus at the end of this story was elevated to the throne of heaven to be King of Kings and Lord of Lords, likewise we also are going to be elevated. We also are going to be lifted up and glorified in the way that God sees fit. That may or may not happen on your timetable, but it will happen. And if Jesus had to go through what he went through to accomplish God's plan, surely it won't be that big of a deal if we go through whatever little suffering, whatever little indignity or hardship we're called upon to go through. I encourage you to study this some more. If we differ a little bit on the minutiae of how this works out, we can deal with that. But please understand the overall lesson here. God is on your side. God is with you. God will always be with you if you are with him. Now, you may not be with him, and we offer you an invitation to return to the Lord if such is the case. If there is something amiss in your life, if you need to turn to the Lord, turn back to the Lord, as the case may be, we certainly want to offer you that opportunity here this evening. If there's anything we can do to help you walk with Christ more perfectly, please come as we stand and sing to encourage you at this time.